Moncrief on News Talk.
Can music be used to help people with neurological conditions? The answer apparently is yes. And on August the 20th, the music therapist Shane Cassidy will be explaining how and why in the Sugar Club. Shane, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
So what happens when somebody listens to a piece of music? What happens in inside the brain?
A lot.
Right.
but plainly. So there's no other stimulus really that actually has quite a reaction as music within the brain. So it's a kind of a widespread activation. So we're talking here about the outer cortex, the inner cortex, left hemisphere, right hemisphere. So if you think of music and you unpack all of the elements of music, each one targeting a specific brain region.
Yeah, and why does it target so many different brain regions?
I guess it's because how layered music is. So if you think of just a regular, even instrumental piece of music, so you've got rhythm, you've got pitch, you've got tonality, you've got harmonies within that, you've got melody line, you've got volume, you've got tempo. So even that alone, never mind the memories or emotional associations you might have with a particular piece of music, add lyrics into that, then you're looking at communication in a slightly different way. Again, those associations that we attach to songs.
Mm, so we're kind of, if we hear a piece of music, we're dividing it up when it enters our brain into those different components.
Exactly. So I suppose the auditory cortex acts as that, I suppose, reception desk. Mm. And it from there, so rhythm, for example, will be projected into the motor system. So you think about all of our movements, they're all rhythmic in nature. But it's also processed in the prefrontal cortex. So rhythm is really key when we look at higher cognitive skills and executive function. So planning and organizing. So rhythm is kind of central to that as well. So that's just rhythm alone that's processed in those three areas.
Yeah, that's interesting. We're listening to music in probably more detail than we're aware.
Absolutely.
At the time. So does that mean then speech isn't processed in as complex a way in the brain?
Singing versus speech, I suppose, it would be the way we'd approach it. So a lot of our clients at Neuralinks would come to us and they may have some sort of speech impairment or speech condition or maybe even speech delay for young children. Mm. And we would be looking at using song as a way of trying to promote speech and language with those children. So we know that speech generally is processed in the left hemisphere. There's a large communication center on the left hemisphere of the brain. But where we sing from is actually a small pocket of a communication area in the right hemisphere. So we're actually targeting a slightly different brain region. So you think of somebody, for example, who's had a stroke or is living with some sort of neurological condition, and maybe their main communication center isn't working as it once did. So what we're doing is trying to reroute the pathway to speech.
Yeah.
And we'll do that through song.
Years ago, I interviewed a fellow who had Tourette's.
Yeah.
And his tic was swearing. It was that classic idea of Tourette's. But he had discovered when he sang, now he was a terrible singer, he had a shocking voice, but when he sang...
It doesn't matter. That's what we say to all of our clients.
No, but when he sang, he, you know, the tick almost disappeared completely, and he put up lots of YouTube videos of himself singing. And, you know, he really took joy in it because he was kind of unencumbered for the first time in his life. It
Absolutely.
Was really interesting. This is the only time I've ever interviewed somebody who called me an arsehole all the way through but it was an absolutely lovely guy. Now, and in terms of physical movement, again, this is, I suppose, that's to do with rhythm, as you said, and that's a different part of the brain.
Yeah.
So is this kind of almost like you're teaching people, you know, to feel a rhythm and then move in time to that rhythm?
Well, actually, really interestingly, this has been studied in depth, and it was actually the subject of my own PhD study, whereby we've been able to show that actually our response, our rhythmic and motor response to music and to rhythm is subconscious. So it actually happens subconsciously. So it's not something that we're consciously aware of. So, for example, if I was walking outside and there was a piece of music playing at 90 beats per minute, I will unconsciously tend to fall into walking at 90 beats per minute. Mm. So we're kind of building on that premise with our clients, for example, at Neuralinks, who come to us and maybe for some reason as a result of a stroke or living with Parkinson's or whatever it might be, their gait or walk pattern isn't as it used to be or as they would like it to be. So we're using rhythm to almost act as a template to promote more symmetrical walk pattern for them.
And is that a process by which you build up the the beats per minute for them.
Exactly. So I suppose safety first is what we would be saying. Yes. So if somebody has any kind of balancing issues, we might be doing some sort of pre-gait exercises, again, using rhythm as the key function, I guess, to promote that increased balance and stability. And going from there then into maybe starting quite a slow walk. And building that up incrementally. It depends. It's very much individual from person to person. With a lot of our Parkinson's clients, for example, we're often trying to promote a slower pace so that their steps will be less of a shuffle and more of a wider stride. Mm.
Are there particular pieces of music that you use for these therapies that are more useful than others?
Well, a great question, because I think what really it comes down to is personal preference. So if we are playing music that is really familiar and a piece of music that somebody really enjoys and is motivated by, what happens is a dopamine release. So the pleasure reward system has been activated and there's a really strong dopamine release. Concurrently, at the same time, there's actually a reduction in cortisol. So anyone who may be a little bit anxious around walking, there's that level of it, first of all. And then what we will do, we'll be playing live music in sessions.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we'll be manipulating the tempo. So we could be playing a piece of music at a very different tempo than you'd be used to hearing it at. So it's very much client-led and person-centred in that
and
way.
So, and you do live music, I assume, for that reason. So
absolutely.
You can adjust the tempo, yeah. Than just a, you know, something streaming even that yeah. You could fiddle
it's,
wouldn't be as good as
that. It's very difficult with recorded music because of that, because maybe somebody is doing quite well and 3 minutes into it, they're actually able to increase their tempo. So we're able to do that in the moment once it's live.
Yeah. So, but then classical music then maybe wouldn't be that useful in that regard, or would it?
It can be. Again, it goes back to personal preference. What we're really looking at there is the tempo that we're playing at, and also, I suppose, the how pronounced the beat is. So you want people to be able to follow that beat. So something with a strong rhythmic beat is probably most beneficial when it comes to walking, for example.
Yeah, and I know this is a how long is a piece of string question, but like what period of time do these kind of treatments go on for, and what kind of results can you see from it?
It varies. So at Neuralink, for example, people tend to come to us maybe once a week. But what we would do is give them a home program then that they can do during the week. So obviously with anything, if we're trying to rebuild and strengthen neural pathways, the key is repetition. So the more often, the more frequently you engage in that program, the better the results will be. So for example, we've kind of tended to be like over an 8 week period, 8 to 12 weeks, we kind of see quite dramatic results. Just depending on where a person is at, you know, if it's a stroke, and it varies from person to person, even if it is the same diagnosis, and depending on their starting point.
Yeah. And the process in the brain during all this, are you, for want of a better term, rewiring it, in that the bit that used to tell you to walk in this manner, now it's a different part of your brain telling
Absolutely.
You to walk in this manner.
Yeah. Another aspect of music that they've studied in depth over the last 25 years is that the ability for music to promote neuroplasticity. Exactly that, just to rebuild and strengthen neural pathways for all of those everyday skills. And because, going back to what I said at the beginning about that widespread activation, that's our hook, that's our key. That's why we can actually get in there and strengthen those pathways, because they're the ones that are being activated when we engage in music.
Okay, so in a way, like if maybe this is too simplistic, but like there was one part of your brain that told you how to walk properly, that isn't functioning as it should.
Yeah.
So can then you choose from a number of different parts of the brain to send that message rather than the one that responds specifically to rhythm?
Yeah. Oh, put very simply, yeah, absolutely. You're really harnessing that subconscious ability for us to synchronize with an external rhythmic cue.
Yeah. One of our listeners wants to know if music therapy can help with neuropathic pain.
Yes, there's actually a lot of research, even here in Ireland, actually, down the University of Limerick, around pain perception. And it goes back to that pleasure reward system and the dopamine release, which can often counteract that pain perception. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our clients would report that, say, for example, we work with people who've had maybe hip replacements or knee replacements. And again, we'd be using rhythm in the same way as I was just describing to help with their walk and their symmetry. But a lot of the time, it's kind of trying to manage that pain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in terms of improving speech, or maybe just bringing back speech at all, what part of music do you use for that, to try and help that?
So again, it varies from person to person, but there's a particular technique called melodic intonation therapy, and it is used quite commonly with people with aphasia. But we often use it as well with people with children, for example, with maybe speech delay or autistic children who are working on their speaking skills.
Funny, somebody just texted in to ask exactly that question.
great minds. So it's what we would do there is a lot of our young clients, particularly at Neuralinks, they're what we call gestalt language processors. So they almost... they speak in terms of chunks of language. So music is so well placed. So what we would do is set functional phrases, phrases that we would use every day to music, so to melody and rhythm, almost making it into a catchy jingle. And from there, we're rehearsing it through song. The idea is not that we want them to go to the cafe and order a coffee in song, but the idea is that we will bit by bit incrementally reduce that singing into speech.
Yeah.
And it works quite, it's very effective with a lot of our clients.
Oh, wow. And so I assume that for people who've had strokes and would have difficulty both moving and speaking, that can be...
Absolutely. It's been huge. We've seen such like profound results, honestly. It depends. There are a few, I suppose, variables within that, depending on what the exact location of their injury, the severity of their injury. Mm. But yeah, it has worked to really good effect.
Somebody texts and say rehabilitation is such a big part of getting better. Like a stroke. My husband suffered a stroke, lost all his speech. It devastated us. Yeah. He's now able to walk, but the speech never came back.
Okay.
So in a case like that, when you have somebody who has lost the ability to walk and speak, I assume it's almost like two parallel forms of therapy you'll be attempting.
Absolutely. Yeah. We would probably be, you know, when someone comes to us, we'll be kind of trying to prioritize. Well, what's the first priority that we need to, for some, it will be the speech. It'll be that communication piece. For others, it is the mobility to be able to actually maneuver independently. But it's often we'd be targeting both within our sessions as well. Yeah. So it's.
Yeah. And the thing is, if somebody doesn't like any of them or they can't present to you, they can't tell you, I really like this kind of music, what do you do then?
We kind of bring it right back to basics. It has happened. And actually, in some cases, it's been the best results we've had. So we would always say to our clients, look, there's no need to have any kind of musical background. I think we have those connotations with music that we need to be in some way skilled or knowledgeable about music to engage in music therapy, which is not the case at all. So, for example, we can just use a very like bare basic rhythm to help with their movement, for example, or just chanting almost, or using song in a very primitive, basic way to support speech.
Mm. Someone else says, this is about their grandfather. My grandfather could still sing all his favourite songs when he was in his final years with dementia.
Yeah.
The music never left him, even though his memory had completely failed. It's amazing that it must be a certain part of the brain that stores these things.
Yeah.
Is it easier to remember music than facts or...
Absolutely. Of course it is. I remember riddling off the, what's that called? The periodic table in science, trying to remember the first 20 elements, and I put it to song, and I could still do it today.
Yeah.
So it's that, again, going back to what I was saying earlier about that jingle effect, you know, nearly creating an earworm. Yeah. And we see it with a lot of our older adults living with dementia or even cognitive decline, whereby how we encode our musical memories is quite different. It's quite unique because we often encode them with a strong emotion.
Mm.
So a lot of the music that person's grandfather was probably singing was something that was emotionally connected. We would often see, you know, a wedding song or a song that they associate with their childhood or something particularly meaningful. And they will sing it from beginning to end with no pause.
In evolutionary terms, does that kind of imply that perhaps music or some early form of it predated language? And that's where language came from.
Perhaps. Yeah, there's a lot of research around that. There really is around using chanting, around using rhythm in particular.
Mm.
And if you even look at primitive tribes that would have communicated from village to village using rhythm.
Yeah.
That was their mode of communication.
Yeah. Somebody wants to know, what about singing in a different language? Is it easier to sing in a foreign language and speak on that basis?
So would there be...
It's probably slightly outside.
Possibly. It depends what their first language is. We have actually worked with people. I've brushed up on some Polish and Russian, for example, recently enough. But in the case of those clients, that was their first language. And as a result of a stroke or whatever it might be, that was their, I suppose, primary language to focus on in terms of their rehabilitation.
Shane, thanks very much for coming in.
Pleasure, thanks for having me.
And Dr. Shane Cassidy, who's a music therapist and director of Neuralinks, will be giving that talk in the Sugar Club in Dublin on August the 20th.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.